Time to go!
Friday edition. Today's date is June 6, 2008. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here with me again for another installment of the French Connection. Lots going on in the world, ladies and gentlemen. Even the statistics can't lie their way out of the mess we're heading into here with this largest unemployment jump in what they say 10 or 15 years or something, 15 or even more. But I happen to think that that's understated, as you all know that these statistics are just lies, and they're a bunch of nonsense. Anyway, what we've got today for you is a little recurring special treat here on the French Connection, the Synagogue of Satan, with my dear friend Andrew Carrington Hitchcock, who I mentioned yesterday had stopped by to help me do some things around the house here. Very kind of him to do that. And we had a great visit, and it was interesting to have Andrew here for his first time on our little farm, and it was great, and we enjoyed it. Lots of good food and lots of good conversation. So I'm going to bring him up, and we're going to do this this thing here today. Andrew, are you with me?
Yes, I am. Nice being with you again, Daryl.
Well, you know, I did mention yesterday's file that you had stopped by, and we got a little work done around here. I was trying to recover a little bit from not feeling so hot, and rose up to the level of work. Actually, we actually were pouring a bit of sweat, weren't we?
Oh yeah, well we got that ceiling up, but yeah. It was good. It was good to meet you, and I think we had some good conversation, and it was nice to visit the lovely farm.
Yeah, well, it's a work in progress, as you noticed, you know. But we're proud of the things we've got here, and we work hard to get our food out of the ground. If the weather will cooperate, in which it hasn't been lately, what we're going to do today, Andrew, is as usual, do a 30-page segment here, starting with 1778. Now, this happens to encompass the period that the Basel, Switzerland conference of Zionism was actually took place. And so what we're going to discuss today is maybe some of the setup of that conference and what was going on at the time. Because we know that the final part of this little discussion, we're going to hear about Rockefeller's Institute being set up and other terrible institutions that have gone on to become very sinister engines of sickness in our world. But we're going to start off with 1778, and you put in Archibald Philip Primrose, the 5th Earl of Rosebery, what sounds like, you know, the 5th Earl of Doobie-Doo. What did the 5th Earl of Doobie-Doo do, this guy?
Well, he was one of these nobles who'd have one of these inherited titles with some earls, and, you know, you get a few lords that we still have that have inherited titles, and this is one of those. So he's nobility, if you like. But the interesting thing here is we mentioned before that L.G. Pine in 1950, somewhere around 1950s, who's the guy who was responsible for Burke's peerage at the time, said that there was no line of British nobility, including, of course, the royal family, that wasn't in some way blood linked to the Zionists or the Jews of that time.
So does that make it? Does that make it an easy statement to make that Britain is a Zionist government?
I think so. I think that the first central bank was set up in Amsterdam, and it was the Amsterdam Jews that came over to set up the Bank of England, and that was. What I find is that there's never been any rebellion against this system. A few people have mentioned now and then that about this group, but essentially they all go along with them. And people, there are these people out there on the internet that will talk about the City of London is behind this and things like that. And, they're right to the extent that their heart has always been in London, really, the Rothschild Empire, etc. They've always kind of gone out of London, but they have to take that additional step to see who's actually behind them. It's not London per se, it's this group. So here with this Archibald Philip Primrose, it's actually he married Hannah de Rothschild, who was the daughter of Maya de Rothschild.
Mm.
This is 1878.
Yep.
And then he goes on in 1894 to be Prime Minister of Britain. So, here we have an actual Rothschild as, the equivalent of the US First Lady type of thing. So I think that's very interesting.
Well, now we get into 1880, and you have evidence here that you state that Rothschild began fomenting discord and problems in Poland and in Russia, causing the exodus of large numbers of ghettoized Jews out of that region of the world, and they made their way to New York and some to London and some to Philadelphia and Boston, and this was a huge influx at the time of very tightly monitored and controlled Jews from the Ashkenazi Jewish sect. Am I correct?
Yes, yes, Dale, you are. It's what we've got here is it's interesting in a couple of ways. They initiate these what are called pogroms, which was encouraging the population to go against the Jews. And it was actually these Rothschild agents, if you like, that were doing this. And this is something that we've seen that they have done since then to get people to move to Palestine, etc., when they did in World War II. But what we've got here is an early example of this, where they were looking to get them to move over to America to increase the power base there, and they'd subsequently get hold of the all their initially they went with the Democratic Party. Of course, now we know that they control both parties.
Mm-hmm.
And then they control the Democratic Party, so they, just as they need a population in Israel to make it a country, they needed a population in America to vote their people in. So as soon as they got these people, which went up to about, I believe we get towards, I think I had a figure here, where we talk about how it was this big influx that they had that helped elect Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, that's right.
And, of course, that's their person. So there's definitely something going on where through their system, they're kind of encouraged as to who to vote for with regard to who their, gods and masters, the Rothschilds, if you like, in this instance are promoting.
Ah. Well, now, this guy, Swinson, he made that famous statement saying, about the press being controlled at this point. What did we talk about? The business of journalism is to destroy the truth and lie outright to prevent or to pervert or vilify or to fawn at the feet of mammon, he says, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Holy smoly. This guy,
yes.
he told the truth. He shocked the whole group, didn't he?
Yeah, well, again, this is another interesting area because we've talked about, I think in the previous file, was certainly touched on before about the control of the media. And if you look, for example, at the protocols, when they talk about getting control of the media, the protocols were put together, I certainly believe that they were the result of the first Zionist conference in Basel, Switzerland in 1897. But these are pre-protocols, if you see what I mean.
Yep.
And so what this guy is saying is he's an eminent, well-respected reporter. He's having his he's at this big dinner. He's a guest of honour. And that's what he says about the press. So it's a bit like when we had that senator over in, I forget his name, a couple of years ago, he stood up in America. And,
yeah. What's his name?
You know about AIPAC?
Yes.
Was it John Hollings?
Yeah.
Or, yeah, he said about AIPAC, he said there's no, or actually the Senate, he said nothing in here is said if it doesn't have the agreement of the Jews, basically.
That's right.
Or Israel, I think he said, was his term. And it's the same sort of thing here. What this guy is saying is, you know, we're not, he actually refers to journalists as intellectual prostitutes, basically prepared to write whatever for their paycheck, and they're not independent. He says, what folly it is toasting an independent press. So back at that far, 1881, this journalist is talking about the press not being independent at all.
Well, now we get into 1881, and Garfield's in office, and yes, he gets murdered right now. He was only in office for how long? President Garfield lasted only 100 days before they killed him. Now, why do you believe they killed him, Andrew? In your research?
Well, firstly, he said, I've got a quote here which must have shocked them no end that someone can come and say this straight out. And the quote is, whoever controls the volume of money in our country is absolute master of all industry and commerce. And when you realise that the entire system is very easily controlled one way or another by a few powerful men at the top, you will not have to be told how periods of inflation and depression originate. So here we have a guy coming into office, and of course these people they've been wanting their central bank back, and ever since Jackson got rid of it in 1835, and they've got the risk here of a guy not only preventing them for another, you know, two terms if he gets re-elected, so for another sort of end of 10 years, or and also the risk that he will let the cat out of the bag with regard to who really controls the country. And, you know, as we know, the political system and the right-left paradigm is just a joke. It's just there to give us an illusion that we have choice when the same people are in control all the way along.
Well, Tsar Alexander was murdered in what does it say, the 13th on 1881. Now, when Tsar Alexander was murdered, this set up Tsar Nicholas, who ultimately was also murdered during the Russian Revolution. It set him up to know who was out after his family, and he began a pogrom of his own against Zionist Jews in Russia, did he not? And this set him up as diametric to this Jewish cabal, didn't it?
Well, I mean, they always had been, and what it came from was back in, I think it's 1815, when the Nathan Rothschild said he swore to take revenge on the Tsar and his descendants if he didn't get him and the Tsar at the time, and this was for their involvement in stopping Britain attacking America over the Americans' war to prevent having another central bank. We had a break in between where they didn't want to renew the license. So the license was for 20 years. I think it was set up by Alexander Hamilton in 1791. And then in, I think it's 1811, we'll talk about this in the next file, I believe. This is when, you know, we've got the license isn't renewed, and so Britain goes to war. When it was just when it was getting heavy, Russia wanted to get involved. So
that's right. They brought ships to San Francisco Bay, and they also threatened to attack ships off the coast of America in support of the United States government's efforts. And this was in fact 1812, the War of 1812, when they burned the original White House to the ground. With bombardment, and in fact, Britain backed off at that point, giving America the opportunity to establish itself. Now, Yes, you're exactly right. Now we get into 1883 here. It says a 6,000 foot of tunnel in the Channel Tunnel project has been excavated, and the British government halts the project, citing the fact that it would be a threat to Britain's security. Ha-ha. And now, of course, we know today we've got that same tunnel. Why isn't it still a threat to British security? But you want to talk about the next one. It says Nathan Rothschild, the son of Lionel. Want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, just to go back, though, quickly to what you said about the 1812 war, I think the other indicator here is that the Rothschilds really worked out that whereas all the other royalty in Europe they'd either married into or they had under their influence through usury, they were never going to break the back of the Russian royalty. And they were never going to be able to buy them off or whatever, and so they realised they were going to have to kill them. And so, of course, that's why in the end we had the communism set up over there. So that's my belief there. With regard to Nathaniel Rothschild, of course, here's another indicator. When you bear in mind the first person who changed his name to Rothschild over in Germany was back in, 130-odd years before this, yep. And now we've already got one of these people who's becoming the first Jewish peer and taking the title Lord Rothschild in the House of Lords in the UK. So it's just really an indicator of the area. I mean, these days, the Rothschild family are strange. We know they're strange, but they don't all follow the exact same line. For example, I think Austria gave some of them noble titles, Austria or France, I believe it's Austria. Nathan Rothschild didn't take it. He wasn't interested in the title. He preferred to be more behind the scenes.
The French also gave the Rothschilds out of Bordeaux the title of Baron.
Yeah, I think that's probably what it is. It is probably the French, actually. But that's something that comes up, I think, in another file, just trying to remember it. But, so I think that, really, some of them were probably interested in getting these titles, and others realised that they had the money and they didn't really want the fame to go with it. They'd rather sort of, because that could be a hindrance rather than a help.
Well, let's go to 1891 here and talk about the Labour leader in Britain making a statement about the Rothschilds. Why don't you read that statement? It's very, very powerful.
Yeah, well, what he says here is, he says, this blood-sucking crew has been the cause of untold mischief and misery in Europe during the present century and has piled up its prodigious wealth, chiefly through fomenting wars between states which ought never to have quarrelled. Whenever there is trouble in Europe, wherever rumours of war circulate and men's minds are distraught with fear of change and calamity, you may be sure that a hook-nosed Rothschild is at his game somewhere near the region of the disturbance. And here we have, this is actually towards the end of the 1800s, the Rothschilds go on to purchase Reuters, which is a very big news agency that's still in existence today, one of the biggest agencies, I think they're with Associated Press.
Yeah. Yep.
In the world. Well, they're the European side, aren't they, really, Reuters?
Yeah. Now the AP, the Associated Press, is also controlled by one of their henchmen, so We can get into that at another time on another file, but here we go into the Edmund James de Rothschild, the youngest son of Jacob Meyer Rothschild, visits Palestine to see Jewish colonies he funded. Now, he was already beginning the funding even before the Basel, Switzerland conference, which happened 2 years after this.
Well, yes, he's the interesting thing about him is that he is really regarded as the father of Israel. Well, you've got a Rothschild Boulevard over there, you know. They're naming it after him. He's on the back of, I think, some of their banknotes. He was the one that Herzl essentially approached, Theodor Herzl. And, of course, we've already talked about the how he got the Jews to move over there and set up colonies through the pogroms in, you know, Russia, Poland, Bulgaria, and Romania. And we go on to 1897 to what you just referred to with the first meeting of the Zionist Congress.
Yep.
And that was Theodore Herzl who chaired this, and he was, you know, regarded, if you like, as the father of Zionism.
Well, now, here's the interesting thing that he starts quoting here. The suffering of the Jews and the pogroms against the Jews and the anti-Semitic efforts against the Jews, when you look into real history, it was their leadership that kept these Jews ghettoized. It was their leadership who fomented hatred against the Jews. And what you'll find is that agents from this leadership group have always worked in society to stir up hatred against Jewish interests. Not unlike I see happening now with my ex-partner.
Yes, I think that it's, you know, these groups, the key here is what they're saying is, I mean, the line it actually says is the anti-Semites shall be our best friends.
That's right.
And this is exactly what we see on a daily basis now. If you want to take it to the top level of, given it, well, the example that we talked about, the pogroms that they were themselves organising hatred of the Jews in these countries in order to get them to move to Israel. But the other thing is to show them all the time as victims, and they know that they needed to do this because of all the countries that they got kicked out of through their use of usury and the allegations of child kidnapping for their religious ceremonies. So really, what we and you can take it from that level right down to the level where, you know, there's a story recently about a Jewish student, a female, who was complaining that people were putting swastikas on her door at college, and then they set up a camera without telling her, and they found it was actually her putting the swastikas on.
Well, there was another girl here who stabbed herself in the stomach on the subway and said it was Arabs, and she was saying they were after her because she was a Jew. And there was somebody kicking over headstones in a cemetery. They caught that person. He was Jewish. And there have been 7 in the last 5 years that they've caught in France that had nothing to do with anti-Semitism. And yet, those things get a mere mention in the press, whereas the other stuff makes headlines and front-page news. So, but, you know, going back to this this situation, Andrew, you yourself have... you can't work today in this world without coming in contact with someone Jewish, or live in this world without coming in contact with someone Jewish. And when you were here, I mentioned to you that... I had been in New York, you know, living, and I saw, you know, a lot of Jewish people. Some of them were just workaday people. You know, one of them was an assistant manager at a store. Another one was worked at a university doing library work and posting books and stuff. I mean, now, granted, their community feeds them a lot of the supremacist ideas, and not very different than what Hagee does to his Christian counterparts, but at the same time, they're not part of the decision-making process. What they are instead, like many British and like many Americans, victims of terrible propaganda, and they've been lied into a situation where they're supporting a criminal enterprise. Now, of course, if they are informed of the truth and they still continue to support the criminal gang, then, of course, now you can hold them liable. But, you know, today, with the sophisticated way these people control people's thinking, all Jews are not involved in this. And I did a little math of my own of all the Jews in the world. It's all 16 million that have been counted right now, estimated. If you divide that into the number of people in the world, there's only 26 Jews for every 10,000 people. Now, of that 26 for 10,000, I would say only one-third of them are really aware of what's happening in this world on behalf of their criminal group. So let's say we've got eight or nine Jews per 10,000 doing this. This is an astonishing ratio, a limited ratio against us when you do the math. The fact is, we have them outnumbered so hugely that we should be able to crush them underfoot. But we cannot, because so many people have been deceived. No different than in their own community, they've been deceived. And As I've told you lately, Andrew, people are, within the Jewish community and the Christian Zionist community, are beginning to leave their fold. They're beginning to wake up and see that the group they've been working on behalf of is a criminal gang. So let's get in back into this this Zionist Congress here in July of Max Mendelstam making the following statement. Could you read that statement, please?
Yes. What Max Mendelstam said. This is another Zionist Congress the year after the first one, 1897. He says, the Jews energetically reject the idea of fusion with other nationalities and cling firmly to their historical hope of world empire. And so he's really making it clear there that it's world domination thereafter. And I think that what you just said about the limited amount of Jews compared with the world population, the thing is if we were self-sufficient, like you with your farm or what have you, you'd be in a situation where these people couldn't, because the reason they control people is through money. That's how they control people. It's as simple as that. If you remove the need for their money and people were self-sufficient, then they'd be very difficult to get you. It's not something that we can implement, but it just goes to show that people are motivated that they need to have these clothes because this is the fashion, and you know they actually run the fashion, what have you.
Yes.
And people are we need the different things that are pushed by these people, the gambling, the all these different elements, and of course things like oil that they control. Oh, we need oil, we need this for power, and they control that. So really the real key is to be able to break away from needing what they're offering.
That's right.
The first way that people can do that is self-sufficiency in as great a way as possible. It's a very difficult thing to do, but people should try and people who have land to try and grow some food of their own and what have you, are really trying to get through without spending money.
Well, I got to be honest with you, it's very hard to do. As you've seen here, there is a huge requirement going in that you work level and minimal equipment level and whatnot, but even with the smallest effort, you can see some results. This is the good side. You know, if you're only able physically to dig up a 10 by 10 foot by 10 foot patch of land and put seeds in, then that's as much food as you'll get, and you'll see the benefit of that 10 by 10 area. But, you know, if you want to feed yourself for a year on it, you need 100 by 100 foot. And then it starts getting into some real work, doesn't it?
Oh, I can imagine. But, yeah, but exactly. It's the sort of, I think really, I mean, if we go back historically, you look at the feudal times in Britain where the workers had to do everything for the, they had their own land that they were able to grow their own food on after they'd done all the work for the landowner, the lord or whatever.
Right, well, sharecroppers or indentured farmers or, yeah. Well, let's go on here and talk about this Zionist Congress to promote Zionism, and then what we go on to the year 1898 when Pope Leo the Eighth states the following about usury. Now, this is interesting because you never hear anything out of the Catholic epistles or any of their teachings anymore that says usury is bad. It used to be that Christianity was opposed to usury. Let's discuss this for a minute.
Well, yes, and I think that there's a couple of things here that you know, in my opinion, the Catholic Church had come, if it wasn't actually set up by this group, which I believe that there's very great evidence of, because if we go through the Middle Ages and what have you, and the power the Catholic Church had, it was out to bleed everybody or they'd go to hell type of thing. You know, sign your money over to the church or you'll go to hell, and it's a religion that certainly from my perspective they require an intermediary to God, which is the same system as you've got with the Jewish religion. With the Catholic religion they need the priest as the intermediary to God, and with the Jewish religion they need the rabbi as the intermediary to God. But here, as we've seen with presidents like Lincoln and what have you, sometimes someone will spring up that they can't control, and we had a pope before John Paul II, who only lasted 30 days before he mysteriously died.
Yeah, now one needs to wonder what that was about, huh?
Well, exactly, and the funny thing is that we've talked to ourselves about the real crime gangs being Jewish in origin, and we go to the film The Godfather 3, where that very event happens when you've got the Al Pacino character, the Godfather, as it were, converting his money into legitimate business and getting involved with the Catholic Church and what have you, and the Pope there, the guy that becomes Pope there, dies in this amount of period of time as well, and it's all to do with the banking corruption and what have you. So it's very good for people to watch that film, and you know, with what we talk about in mind, and they will see the stories being shown there. But what this Pope here said on the usury was, on the one hand, there is the party which holds the power because it holds the wealth, which has in its grasp all labour and trade, which manipulates for its own benefit and its own purposes all the sources of supply, and which is powerfully represented in the councils of state itself. On the other side, there is a needy and powerless multitude, sore and suffering. He goes on to say, rapacious usury, which although more than once condemned by the church, it's actually condemned in the Bible, is nevertheless under a different form, but with the same guilt, still practiced by various and grasping men, so that a small number of very rich men have been able to lay on the masses of the poor a yoke little better than slavery itself.
I think the word you were looking for is avaricious.
Avaricious, yeah.
But yes, and in fact, what we see here, ladies and gentlemen, thinking back to your Islam here, and what we have today is a watering down of the Islamic restrictions against usury in individual states, and they've found ways of around usury by charging exorbitant fees in order to get loans through the Muslim banking structure, which turns out to be, in percentage-wise, a usury setup. So they're out after enslavement of every single person on earth. And they know darn well that if you owe big loans and owe a lot of money, you are very unlikely to be risking any of your efforts in the event something comes along, because you don't want to lose what you've got. And they keep everybody quiet that way. Now, I've looked into this next subject at length, and I have discussed it with people in South Africa. The Boers were basically farmers. They were people who had, back in the 1670s, 80s, 90s, had staked out land in the fertile plains of South Africa and began farming. And they were Dutch and English mix, but mostly Dutch settlers. And what was discovered, there is gold under their land and diamonds. And so they sent the British military down there to slaughter these people, to murder them wholesale. And it was the first example of a concentration camp system in the modern era. And it was done at the hands of the British Zionist-controlled government. But you want to add a little color to that little description, Andrew, please?
Yes, and I think another thing I'll throw in here is they were after, of course, the mineral wealth there, the gold and the diamonds, but as far as I'm concerned, the research that I've done further to this book, diamonds certainly are not very rare at all, but they're all controlled by the same group.
Yep.
And as a result, if one group controls, it's the same thing. I think that it's very pertinent now to sort of say about when we look at the situation with, oh, we can't drill in Alaska for oil because that might hurt a single rare species that lives there. I mean, it's just absolute nonsense. They don't care at all about these things, and this goes to show how they create scarcity in order to create wealth for themselves.
That's right.
They control all these things. So here we've got them getting control of the diamonds, but in the current day and age, anybody who really believes part of this environmental movement really hasn't studied what they need to study, because it's so simple to create it. The benefit of the environmental movement is just to say, hey, we can't do this because, you know, that'll damage the environment. But what they're really doing is they're saying, we don't want to drill here because that'll show that there's more oil, for example, than we have. Than we have at the moment. If we can say we can't do it for that reason, then we're going to keep our prices high. So we make more. more money.
Well, and then I've often said that I believed the war in Iraq and the attempts to get Iran involved are not to covet their oil, but rather to eliminate it as a source for world supply.
Yeah, I think that's I think you're absolutely correct. The key is to get control of something that everybody needs. Now, people don't need diamonds, but oil is something that people need, and we just need to look at, the stories of people that have invented cars that can run on water, and they mysteriously never come out. People are bought off. With all this in mind, the key is to get control of something that people need in their daily lives and get control of all of it, because then you can monopolize it. And that's exactly what they're doing. And here, we talked about with the Boer War, and I think and this quote I like, because this is Rear Admiral Henry Hamilton Beamish giving a speech some 40 years after this, in 1937, he said, "The Boer War occurred 37 years ago. Boer means farmer." And I think just the term Boer means farmer is extremely important, because it's the way they manipulate us. So refer to it as the Boer War. If you called it the Farmer War, we went to war against a load of farmers, it doesn't sound quite so nice there. And so they've used the term Boer, the translated term. But he says, "Many criticised the great power like Britain for trying to wipe out the Boers. Upon making inquiry, I found all the gold and diamond mines of South Africa were owned by Jews, and that Rothschild controlled gold, Samuels controlled silver, Baum controlled other mining, and Moses controlled base metals. Anything these people touch, they inevitably pollute." And then the president of Transvaal Republic in South Africa in 1899 made the following vote. He said, "If it were conceivable to reject the Jew monopolists from this country neck and crop without incurring war with Great Britain, then the problem of everlasting peace would be solved." So he was aware who was pulling Britain's chain, and he said that if he could get rid of them without risking war with Britain. So he's already telling you there who controls Britain, and this is going back to over 100 years ago.
That's right, and by virtue of the close links between America and Britain forged over this last century, and by their mass immigration that we just discussed in the 10 minutes earlier here, we see that America is in the exact same position of control that Britain had fallen into. And so now it's the British, American, and Israeli alliance, coupled with this new French alliance coming out of this Sarkozy group, that is pushing the world into this nightmare we face imminently. Let's go into the 1901 here. It says the Jews from the colonies are set up in Palestine. Now, this is only 4 years after the Ball Switzerland first Zionist Congress, and they're already beginning to move masses of willing Jews out of Europe and into the Palestine region. So they were already committed to this idea long before World War II, ladies and gentlemen. So take a peek here. Give them a little insight into this.
Well, what we've got here, the interesting thing is we've got a colony, some representatives from colonies that have already set up, Jewish colonies that have already set up in Palestine, have approached Edmund Rothschild, and at that point they're calling it the Yishuv, which is the Jewish settlement, and they're saying, "Can you leave us alone? We'll develop over here. We're quite happy, but you keep poking your nose in." And he turns around to them and says, "I created the Yishuv, I alone, therefore no men, neither communists nor organizations, have the right to interfere in my plans." So this is the message I really send out to Jewish people who are listening, to say these people aren't creating a homeland for the Jews, they're creating a land that they can manipulate, that they can base a particular race in, which is the Jews, and they're part of that race. But the reason that they're doing it is a very clever ploy of hiding their activities behind the race as a whole. So, for example, if I went out murdering people and then I got arrested and sentenced to death or whatever, I'd say, "Right, that's not you're having to go at English people by doing this to me."
Yeah. And